May it please the court. Good morning. I'm Jacob Shellabarger, the prosecuting attorney of Audrain County. With me is Regina Falkenberry, the assistant prosecuting attorney of Audrain County. Ms. Floatman, good morning. Here today on behalf of the state of Missouri, an appeal from a misdemeanor, from an interlocutory appeal from the Associate Circuit Court of Audrain County, where the trial court dismissed the information, the second amended information, on the appellants, on the original information charge of failure to comply with Halloween-related restrictions for sex offenders under 589.426 of the state of Missouri. The information, ladies and members of the court, was filed November 26th of 2008. The trial court sustained a defense motion to dismiss a second amended information on April 23rd of 2009. Mr. Rayner was convicted of, has not been convicted, an interlocutory appeal. He was convicted in 1988 in Washington State for indecent liberties with a child. He was charged with the violation of the Halloween-related sex offender restrictions because on October 31st of 2008, a Mexico public safety officer observed the defendant was not observing those restrictions, namely that his porch light was on, that he was in the residence itself, and other things as set forth in the brief. The issue for the court today is whether Section 589.426 violates Article 1, Section 13's prohibition on retrospective laws. The position of the state of Missouri is that it does not violate that provision concerning retrospective laws of the state of Missouri because that it's a present and continuing duty of the defendant to comply with the requirements for sex offenders. Particularly, the language of the statute requires Mr. Rayner's compliance with that statute because he was required to register as a sex offender in the state of Missouri. This court has also upheld similar collateral consequences of conviction, such as the requirement for sex offenders to continue to register with the continuing duty to register, as well as their duty to inform the chief law enforcement officer of each county of a change of residency, of a change of their particular demographic information, such as in State versus Holden.
Now, this crime that he's been charged with, what are the elements of that offense?
Your Honor, the particular elements of the offense require that an individual required to register as a sex offender on October 31st of each year first avoid all Halloween-related contact with children. Second,
no, but when you charge him, you're charging him with not doing something, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
He's supposed to turn the light off, put up a sign, no candy.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And so that's the first element of the offense is that he has a sex offense conviction, regardless of when it is.
Yes, Your Honor, that he was required to.
The second thing that you would have to prove in this prosecution is that he failed to keep his light off and put a sign up.
Your Honor, I'd actually think that the first thing would be that he's required to register as a sex offender, as opposed to that he was convicted as before. I believe it to be a subtle distinction, but an important distinction, whether this is Mr. Rayner was required to comport his conduct with this because of his status in the particular class which the legislature designated as a sex offender, as opposed to other cases that this court has considered where the defendant was required to complete a particular action based on his prior sex offense.
But don't you think that that's a requirement that's imposed because of the prior sex offense?
The requirement to register is a continuing and present duty for him.
No, but the reason he's required to register is that he has a conviction for a sex offense. So don't you think that the conviction for the sex offense is the reason why he has to both register and he has to keep his registration, whatever that is, and he has to do these things on Halloween?
Yes, Your Honor, that's a part of that, but I don't believe his conviction is the sole basis for his requirement to continue to comply.
Well, if he didn't have a sex offense conviction, you wouldn't be here, would you?
That's fair to say.
Okay.
He is required to register under federal law, is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. his sex offense from, although from prior to the Missouri effective date, he would be required to register under federal law under SORNA, which came into effect in 2006. And so the defendant would have a continuing duty to register under Missouri law, I believe under 589.400 subsection 7, the continuing duty of individuals to register as sex offenders based on requirements on out of state, but also under federal law, requirement that they register, required to register under federal law.
If we found this was appropriate and the restrictions on handing out candy and so forth appropriate, could the legislature say next year enact a law that said you can't go outside in the evening during the summer if children are playing, or you can't go outside if children live in the neighborhood? Where would be the limit on what, or would there be a limit on what the legislature could impose by statute as collateral consequences? Do you see what I'm saying? If it's okay to restrict going outside or opening your door to others or keeping the porch light on Halloween, and we understand why that was chosen, but legally, if that's permissible, what's the difference between that and saying you can never have your light on or you could never leave your home?
Your Honor, I think the particular difference is in the heightened awareness, the heightened level of crime, the public safety interest in protecting individuals just at that time. I agree with you that there is a limit, and I can't give you a straight answer, Your Honor, exactly as to where that line is, but I believe these restrictions are, although we're not here on an individual rights argument, this is specifically retrospective and application, but if we were to go down that route, this is a compelling state interest, and this is a narrowly tailored, least restrictive means of protecting children at that time and protecting that public safety interest. I believe the legislature has tailored these particular restrictions in a particular way and chosen their words carefully in doing so. And I think this I don't know where the line is, Your Honor, but I think this is clearly on the lawful side of it.
Okay. So if the person liked All Saints Day, November 1st, liked All Saints Day and put out lights and banners and said, come get candy in All Saints Day, that'd be fine.
Doesn't
just Halloween.
Yes, Your Honor, this law doesn't appear to prevent that.
And there is no challenge, as you just stated, to the law being constitutional. The only question is whether the Missouri Constitution prohibits the application to this defendant because his conviction occurred prior to the enactment date of the law. There's no challenge that the law itself is unconstitutional. It's simply the application to someone who was convicted prior to the date of enactment.
Yes, Your Honor, the retrospective and application. I think particularly as we look at this law, this statute was passed, was signed into law by the governor, became effective August 28th of 2008. And this defendant had more than 2 months of notice at that time. And he's charged based on his actions on October 31st of 2008, and more than 2 months later, his status as a sex offender on October 31st of 2008. If the defendant had not been required to register as a sex offender on October 31st of 2008, I submit that he would not have had to comply with the Halloween-related restrictions.
You haven't addressed the actual language of the constitutional prohibition against retrospective laws, and it prohibits the imposition of a new duty or a new disability. Why is this not, and it's simply on the basis of his status as a sex offender who's required to register, he now has a new duty or a new obligation, does he not?
He does, but it's because of his status as a member of that class, as a member of that grouping. This court has also held other restrictions valid where it didn't change the legal effect or the facts of the transactions that occurred before the effective date, but it put him in a group for a status of the operation. And his conviction occurred, I believe that's State versus Holden, State versus Harmon, and State versus Olive, all cases that this court has considered are particularly instructive as far as actions that refer to things that happened before, and then a statute was enacted, and then a conviction occurred afterward.
About Cannon v. Cannon?
Your Honor, I also believe Cannon v. Cannon is also instructive in this case. It talks about the changes in the status of supervised visitation versus unsupervised visitation and upheld that further restriction on sex offenders' right to have supervised visitation. In that case, this court held that the defendant did not have a right to unsupervised visitation and held that that was a collateral consequence of conviction.
So
and I believe this
in several cases, we've said these new restrictions, these new additional duties are permissible because they're collateral consequences.
Yes.
This is going to be kind of dovetailing on Judge Stiff's question. Where do you draw the line between what's a collateral consequence and what is purely restricted by our Constitution?
I think that it is a very fine line, and I think drawing that line comes down to looking at the particular facts, what the legislature has particularly decided to do in that case. In this case, it looks at the status of the person at that time and their particular issue at that time. I'm not sure I'm answering your question.
You refer to the federal requirement that he register. The federal requirement, though, says nothing about Halloween.
The federal requirement doesn't say anything about Halloween, Your Honor.
I think Judge Russell's question was, what is a collateral consequence? What makes it a collateral consequence as opposed to a direct consequence?
A collateral consequence would be one that while the defendant is placed in that class, additional restrictions can be placed on him. It's not the same gravity or the same level, but it's the same as in saying that it's someone who has a driver's license. The state legislature can continue to place requirements on a person who has a driver's license. That felons can't own guns is a collateral consequence of conviction.
But those are regulations. These are things that result in a criminal conviction if he fails to comply.
That's correct.
So it's not that he can't apply for selling Halloween candy. It's that if someone in the house does distribute Halloween candy, he's convicted of a crime. That's very
right.
Different than not driving or something. One's regulatory, and the other is directed at him and what he and imposes an affirmative obligation on him. In effect, adding a new duty or obligation based solely on his prior obligation?
Your Honor, I see that my time has expired. I'd like
Please
to answer
go ahead
your question.
And answer.
Thank you. I think the difference being is that this has continued to be related to the vigilance of the state in tracking sex offenders and being able, I think it's more similar to the additional restrictions placed on them, that they have to continue to report where they live, that they continue to have to comport their conduct with the sex offender restrictions, that they have to continue to provide demographic information, updates, and those kind of things. I believe it's more closely aligned with those.
Thank you,
Your Honor.
May it please the Court. Your Honors, I've been trying myself to decide the last few days where to draw the line that I see in some of the cases. And I think that the cases such as Cannon, such as Olive, can be reconciled with the Doe v. Phillips line of cases because there's two tests for whether a law is retrospective. One is whether it adds new duties or obligations and restrictions. But the other test that has been used is whether it impairs a vested or substantial right. And both of those tests appear in the cases, but I would assert to you all that where the distinction has been drawn, in cases such as Phillips, where affirmative duties are imposed, where it is something active rather than passive that someone has to do, that is where those laws have been found to be unconstitutionally retrospective as applied.
Is that, in other words, in the Doe, just to take the Doe requirement for a moment, the state can keep track of people who have sex offenses.
In fact, in Phillips,
but you can't require somebody
to register.
To register,
exactly.
Because
in Phillips
that's your distinction between
held that they couldn't be required to go out and register. But once that information was out there, the state could continue to publish it.
Well, how do you reconcile that with the dam case, which is the Olive case, where the dam was built beforehand, and then a law was passed afterwards saying you had to go get a drawing, an engineer's drawing, and a permit to build a dam? Why wasn't that creating a new obligation, just like the obligation to put up a sign at Halloween?
I think, Judge, that the Olive case is closer to the Bliss versus Hazardous Waste Management case, which is cited in the state's reply brief, Bliss is actually cited in Phillips, and Bliss is a case where there was also a condition precedent to a license being issued. It was a hazardous waste license. And in that case, it was considered to be that the court's test was whether it impaired a vested right or not, not whether it was imposing a new duty. And I think that the discussion you all were having with the state's attorney earlier is important, that this does impose a new criminal conviction rather than simply being a regulatory screen.
Well, in the Dam case, it was a new criminal conviction. They could be fined $100 a day.
They could be fined. That's
correct,
Your Honor.
So what's the difference?
I think it's different because it was based on the current existence, operation, and safety of the dam rather than a single past criminal act, as was an issue in Phillips. Now,
it wasn't because they built a dam in the past. It's because they were continuing to operate the dam.
It was
ongoing.
And, you know, someone can decide to not operate a dam. Mm-hmm. Someone can decide to sell a piece of property if they don't want to be subject to the regulatory police power of the government. Someone can decide to divest themselves of a piece of property. Someone can decide that I no longer want to be in this particular business if I don't want to comply with regulations that the government has imposed, even new regulations. But someone can't decide I don't want to be a registered sex offender anymore.
Are you saying then that in this case, this gentleman's vested right to hand out Halloween candy is being impaired?
I'm not, Your Honor. I'm saying that in this case...
What's his vested right here?
I'm saying that that particular test is not as applicable as the test where a law is retrospective. It imposes a new duty or obligation,
the case law is that those are disjunctive tests, that a law can't violate any of those, and so it doesn't have to violate all of them.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. I don't think we need to reach the vested right
okay.
test.
Okay, go ahead.
Missouri's Constitution says... Missouri, the legislature shall not enact a law retrospective in its operation. And so when federal law has imposed additional requirements, we've found that doesn't violate the Constitution,
restrictions in the federal law. There's a Halloween, and I looked to make sure, but SORNA does impose a registration requirement. As Mr. Schellebarger pointed out, Mr. Rayner would not have been required to register under this court's jurisprudence in Doe v. Phillips because he was convicted prior to Missouri's Megan's Law. He was convicted in 1990 in the state of Washington. But after Doe v. Keithley, he is now required to register. Interestingly, he wasn't in that gap. And I think you could actually avoid this whole question by saying he wasn't required to register on Halloween of 2008. I think you would like to reach the constitutional question. But there's an argument to be made that he wasn't even required to register on Halloween of 2008 because it was prior to Doe v. Keithley. Now,
Could one argue, if I understood part of the state's argument, was that he was really required to, these disabilities not being allowed to hand out the candy and so forth were imposed based upon his failure to register, which was required by federal law currently, so it's not really retrospective.
The statute says required, the statute 589-426 that we're talking about says any person required to register as a sex offender under sections 589-400 to 589-425. So it specifically says you have to be required to register under the Missouri law.
And it doesn't say under federal law, or those don't say if you're required to register under federal law.
No, it does not. It does not say required to register under any jurisdiction's law.
At the opening of your argument, you made an active-passive type distinction in approaching some of these matters. Does that mean we should treat the active requirement of a sign differently than the passive requirement not to hand out candy or not to answer the door?
I hadn't drawn that distinction, Your Honor, and I think that this statute does implicate other constitutional rights. Judge Breckenridge asked if there were those others implicated in this case, and in the circuit court, this case was challenged very broadly with all sorts of constitutional challenges. I'm here as respondent because the circuit judge found it to be retrospective in nature. So that is the only issue before us.
But under your analysis, your active-passive analysis,
under
it would
the active,
be one thing
passive
to say
analysis,
we could not make you put up a sign. But it would be a total another thing to say passively, don't answer your door, don't turn on your lights, don't hand out candy.
I think the way
that doesn't require activity.
Why? Yes, Your Honor. I think the way this statute is worded, that this court is going to have to find the whole thing violates Article 1, Section 13, because the way those clauses are drafted, they avoid Halloween-related contact with children, remain inside, put out the special sign, and turn off the porch light.
Well, all of those things.
And in fact, it's written as an active word.
Those first three are all passive. I mean, they're not requiring him to do anything.
At best, only two are passive.
Or are they requiring him to stay indoors?
I think they're requiring him to stay indoors. It does say remain inside.
And do even passive requirements fit under the disability?
I think that is a disability. And I think the sort of passive requirements I was talking about were the sort that, as in Phillips, the state could still, people could still go out and publish information about him. But it wasn't something that he had to do, even something as passive as staying indoors. I think that was the sort of active-passive distinction I was trying to draw.
Excuse me. How do you distinguish, then, Cannon v. Cannon, where we upheld visitation limitations on sex offenders, requiring supervised visitation? Is that an active-passive distinction, or how do you determine that to be a collateral consequence versus what's going on here?
And I don't think it's really a question of a collateral consequence, but in Cannon, this court held that there was really no new duty or obligation imposed, because at the time the law changed, the father in Canada did not have the unsupervised visitation that he was later seeking. It was a change in the law that prevented him from seeking something new rather than imposing something new rather than changing his circumstances. So he wasn't. He did not have unsupervised visitation with his children that was then taken away from him as a result of that change in the law. He did not have.
But if he had been maybe, let's say, a father that had free visitation without supervision, how would you have thought we should have ruled on that type of hypothetical?
I think maybe that would have been in a different circumstance then. I think that would have been distinguishable from Cannon, Your Honor. I think it's the fact that in Cannon.
He didn't have it to begin with.
The question in Cannon was whether that change in the law impaired a vested or substantial right. And this court held under that test that he did not have a vested right in unsupervised visitation because he didn't have it at the time the law changed. So I think it still goes back to the distinction in those two tests. I think that Bliss and Cannon and Olive were analyzed under the impairing a substantial right test, and Phillips, R.L., which is the residing within 1,000 feet of a school case, was also analyzed in terms of imposing a new duty or obligation. R.L. had to move, would have been required to move out of his home because of the change in the law, and this court held that, no, that would have been a new duty or obligation, and that law was retrospective as applied to him and therefore unconstitutional.
I have a question concerning the fact that he was convicted under Washington state law. This isn't a Missouri conviction. As I understand Section 13, the bigger idea behind it is at the time you are, or prior to the time you commit the act, you should know what law it is you're violating. You know the consequences of conviction and what duties or disabilities that might flow from that. Do we then look to Washington law to see what duties or disabilities would have come from his conviction there, since that's what he would have been looking at, as opposed to Missouri law? Isn't this one step more complicated because it is resulting from a conviction that occurred out of state?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because I think that the Missouri Constitution prohibits Missouri from enacting laws that are retrospective in nature. He is being prosecuted under a Missouri law that came into effect in August of 2008 for actions he committed in October of 2008. The fact that he has this prior conviction in the state of Washington, whether the state of Washington would have required him to register, whether they would have required him to not participate in Halloween activities in the state of Washington if he had remained there, I don't think has any impact on the actions he's being charged with here, or the Missouri statute that we are challenging is unconstitutional under the Missouri Constitution, simply because of the way the constitutional provision is worded, that this state cannot enact provisions that are retrospective in nature. Had I been raising this as an ex post facto challenge, possibly. You know, we've been talking about whether things.
But it would be a slightly, yes, Judge, it would be a somewhat different case, however, if at the time of his conviction in the state of Washington, one of the known consequences was that under Washington law, he couldn't hand out candy on Halloween.
I think if we were talking about whether this was vague or overbroad, that might be a question, because then we would be looking at notice and collateral consequences. I still don't know that Missouri could impose new restrictions on him once he had moved to the state of Missouri if those were not consequences that existed at the time of his conviction. Because Missouri has passed a new law that restricts people from this point forward.
Would it make a difference if the law had been in effect before he moved? That he would have the choice of moving to Missouri and being subject to a law that was in existence?
It might again impact a vagueness argument, Your Honor, from the point of view of notice. I think it still would be retrospective as applied to him if it wasn't in effect at the time he was required to register as a sex offender, or at the time he was convicted. I think that's the relevant time period that we would look at, which was in 1990, prior to even there being a Megan's Law in the state of Missouri.
Did your motion to dismiss below raise the argument that his only requirement for registration was the federal law, and therefore the Halloween restrictions did not apply to him?
I don't believe so. I don't believe that's in that motion. The motion is very broad and has things in it like the latent commerce clause. It was, I think, covers just about everything, but I think that argument is something that I discovered in researching this case. I did want to mention that the state's argument that his obligation only arises on Halloween's after 2008, and that's one reason the law is not retrospective, because a similar argument was raised by the state in Doe v. Phillips, and this court found that it doesn't matter that failure to register doesn't arise until after Megan's Law became effective, because it's the registration itself that is at issue, not the criminal charges that can be imposed after. Thank you.
Mr. Schallenberger, did you allege in your information that he was a person required to register under sections 589.400 to 589.425?
The second amended information, Your Honor, I believe does lay out that the defendant was required to register as a sex offender because of his prior conviction. And I believe that as opposing counsel.
Because I think in your first argument you were telling us that he was required to register because of the federal requirement. But the Missouri statute on Halloween only refers to the state Megan's Law requirements.
It does, Your Honor, but I believe 589.400.1 subsection 7 refers to defendants required to register as a sex offender under other states' law or federal law, which would have encompassed the defendant's prior conviction and made that a requirement for him to register under Missouri law as well. As far as some of the arguments offered by opposing counsel, I believe that just the fact that the prior fact of the defendant's conviction is one of the factors that led to him being classified as a sex offender, this is not the key issue and is not determinative. In Harmon and Holden, this court held that is a factor to be considered, but not the sole factor. And the prior conviction is not the date of the prior conviction, just the fact that he was required to register under federal law and under Missouri law. Under federal law, under 589.1, subsection 7, is not solely determinative. And I believe that the Halloween-related restrictions are prospective in application. We're just looking at what happened on Halloween 2008, Halloween 2009.
Are there any other questions?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Case is taken under submission.